So glad to see you tonight, and very thankful for especially those who are visiting with us. We're glad that you've made the time to come. If you're new to an assembly like this, we want you to feel welcome here. And if there are questions that arise from the lesson or something else, we want you to feel free to talk to us afterward. We'll be around, and we'd be more than glad to try to answer your questions about what we do and why we do it. For those who are members of the church here at Kimberly, on this last night of the meeting, I got more to say to you than I got time to say it before I begin the lesson, but let me just maybe suffice by saying thank you so very much for everything that you've done this week, for your invitation to come, for the way you've made me feel useful, for the kind way that you've listened, for all of your encouragement. I thank you for that. And not that my think so mean a lot, but I want to, in parting with you at this time, just tell you it's a privilege to work with you. And I have a lot of hope and respect for what you're doing here. My prayer for you is that you would always love God and that you would love one another and that you would love this work. This is a special place. You have, in my opinion, you have a lot of gifts here. You have some sweet little ones, and you have some fine young people, and you have some older Christians who have proven their mettle. And you have folks in between with ability. That's a great blessing. Sometimes I wonder if members of a local congregation are always thinking about the greener grass somewhere. I haven't heard that here, but I wonder about that sometimes. Let me tell you, you got a lot of green grass right here. And you got a lot of work to do as well. And always remember this, and you know this is true. Let me tell you, when God gives a gift, He expects it to be used for His glory. So all the gifts that you have here, put them to use and don't be satisfied with less than doing the best you can. I appreciate you so much, and that'll have to suffice for now. But thank you very much for everything you've done, for feeding us and for taking care of us and just making this such a special and enjoyable week for me. I wished it passed as quickly for you as it did for me. Would you bear with me if I tell you a personal little anecdote as we begin the lesson? I had an opportunity. The first time I ever went to Washington was sort of not planned. We went to Virginia to attend a meeting, and we were busy all day and in the evening, and the guy we were staying with said, "You ever been to Washington?" "No." "Well, you can't come this far and not see the city." And I said, "Well, I don't have time to see the city. I'd love to." He said, "Well, I'll take you out after service tonight." And I thought, okay. Well, he worked in town, and he was a local, so I just put myself in his hands, and off we went after service. Now, by the time you get from Virginia over into Washington, you guys have been there, some of you, you know there's traffic all the time. And, it was the first time I could remember being in a city where you need a traffic report at 10:30 at night. You know, that was very new. I knew I wasn't, you know, home when I heard that. But we get over there, and what I didn't realize was, at least at this time, you know, obviously the museums are closed, but the memorials are open. They're open till midnight, 1 o'clock, I don't know. I bought a card in the gift shop of the Lincoln Memorial about 11:30 one night. And we went over to the Jefferson Memorial. I remember when this was. It was 1992. In the fall and November of 1992. And why I remember that was there had just been an election in the country. And this is not a political speech. But I just being frank with you, you know, the United States had just elected a fellow as president that year that was a flag-waving, card-carrying philanderer. And just an immoral man, and everybody knew it, and everybody said, "Yep, that's the guy we want. We don't care about it. and I was feeling pretty low. And so we got over to the Jefferson Memorial, which if you've been there, you know that's not really close to anything. It's just out. And I didn't know much about the memorial. I'd seen pictures of it. I knew Jefferson statues in there. But what struck me was I was walking in there, and they have, as you may know, along the wall there, quotations from Jefferson's writings. Jefferson was a deist, but sometimes he could write remarkably reverent things. Anyway, here I am feeling low and feeling in awe and all the rest of it, and I look up on the wall of the Jefferson Memorial, and these are the words that I found. God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that His justice cannot sleep forever. And it was just one of those moments where a chill went down my back and I thought, I have literally seen the handwriting on the wall. You know, we live in times that are troubling. And it's just inevitable to Bible students when you see a nation heading in a certain direction, your mind goes back to the prophets. I want you to take a Bible with me tonight, and we're just going to read a few passages together and make a few comments as we look at the book of Jeremiah. I had scruples about preaching this lesson, I have to tell you, because I learned after I'd planned to preach this lesson, you guys are studying Jeremiah. And that can be, you know, and I know Larry, among others, doing an excellent job teaching this material, and he don't need me to mess this up. But then I thought, well, you know, how much damage can I do in a few minutes? So he can straighten it out. But it's certainly, our minds are drawn to a book like Jeremiah. And it's no wonder to me that this is a topic of study here. Let me offer one other thought before we begin as well. I know that Judah is not the United States. And I ain't Jeremiah, that's for sure. But I do believe that there are principles, and you do too, principles from the prophets. God's dealing with nations through the years that certainly ought to teach us, instruct us, prepare us as we face the circumstances of our lives. When you open the book of Jeremiah, the very first words of this great prophet set the scene for us here. Jeremiah did live in dark times. The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests that were in Anathoth, in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign. It also came in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, unto the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, unto the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the 5th month. You know, we think about Josiah, and you're well familiar with him, many of you are. He was a reforming king, and he certainly is a heroic figure, cut down in his prime, we would say. 39 years old, wasn't he, when he died in that ill-fated effort to interfere with the war between Egypt and Syria. But anyway, as you think about this great reformer, it's also significant that when he died, how quickly the nation turned right back to evil. And the point's been made many times. How can something like that happen? It happens because the reforms are on the surface, or the reforms are in the mind of a man like Josiah, but they're not in the hearts of the people. Sometimes we look around us and we think, we wish we could, I'll pick on Larry again. Why don't we make Larry dictator? And boy, he'd get some stuff straightened out, wouldn't he? Well, he might. He'd close down some of these places, you know. He'd get rid of the pornography bookstores, and he'd take care of the gambling joints, you know, and close the liquor stores, and he'd be mighty unpopular. And as soon as they could, folks would go right back to that because people's hearts have not been changed. I'm not against making laws that way, but we all understand, like the Lord said, the kingdom is within you. And until it's there, then there's a great limit to what can be done. And so Jeremiah lived in times. Even when reformers were there, Jeremiah cried. He cried when Josiah died because he knew it was going to get worse. And it did. Jeremiah was not alone, however. There were others. Remember Baruch the scribe. We remember the contemporary prophets. And there's a lesson there as well. You know, we're never really alone, are we? And I'll tell you, we don't know what the future might hold, but I'll promise you this. Whatever it holds, we're not the first. We won't be the last. And there are others who have faced these same times. It's important, I think, to remember that. Something else that strikes me about Jeremiah from the very start, he wasn't exactly a volunteer. The Lord said, I formed you in the belly. I knew you. Before you came out of the womb, I sanctified you. And he said, oh God, my Lord, my God, I cannot speak. I am a child. And God said, don't you say you're a child. Jeremiah might have been 20 years old, by the way, thereabouts. Don't you say you're a child. Notice the pronouns here. For thou shalt go, and all that I send thee, whatsoever I command thee, thou shalt speak. Be not afraid of their faces. I will be with thee to deliver thee, saith the Lord. The Lord put forth his hand, touched my mouth, and the Lord said to me, I have put my words in your mouth. I've set you this day over these kingdoms to pull them down, nations to pull them down, to root out, to pull down, to destroy, to overthrow, and to plant and to build. A couple of stories here that again bring the mind of Jeremiah back to the fact that the need is for watchfulness, and the trouble is soon coming from the north. Expect it to be so. And we find the reminder from God here in verse 17, beginning where he says to Jeremiah, therefore gird up thy loins and arise and speak unto them all that I have commanded thee, and be not dismayed at their faces, lest I confound thee before them. Behold, I have made thee this day a defense city, an iron pillar, bronze walls against the whole land, against the kings and the princes and the priests and the people. That's all you're going to have to face, by the way. That's all your opposition will be. Only the king and the princes and the priest and the people. Other than that, everybody will be for you. So here's your work. But remember this, you work for me. They shall fight against thee, verse 19. But they shall not prevail against thee, for I am with thee, saith the Lord, to deliver thee. And so with that commission, Jeremiah began his work, and he faced certainly a hard fight against a hardened people. You look in the second chapter, and we're not trying to cover Jeremiah chapter by chapter, by the way, but they were blessed people. We're not saying that the United States is Judah, but certainly we can be reminded of the glory that God bestowed upon Judah. He says in chapter 2 about the kindness, the days of God's relationship with them early on, drawing them out of the wilderness, blessing them along and along. God says, what iniquity? What iniquity, verse 5, have your fathers found in me that they are gone from me? They have walked after vanity and are become vain. Neither said they, where is the Lord? They don't even talk about the Lord. They are ashamed of his name. They have instead defiled, verse 7, my land. And the priest said not, where is the Lord? Verse 8. And they that handle the law knew me not. The pastors also transgressed against me. And the prophets prophesied by Baal and walked after things that are of no profit. Though blessed they've been, how thankless they are. What's the old song we used to learn as children? America, God shed his grace on thee. What nation might be blessed as we are, and yet how thankless, how ashamed of God we are. In fact, look in verse 11. You remember this passage. Hath a nation changed their gods which are yet no gods? You know, Moab is loyal to their false gods. But my people have changed their glory for that which doth not profit. He said, it's amazing. There are two sins here. In the first place, they've turned from me. And secondly, he says, they've turned to vanity, to a broken cistern. You know, if you like to read history like I do, it's really instructive to see how history books have changed. You know, there was a time when you could pick up a history and you could read favorably about quote-unquote Christian missionaries. I don't know what all they were teaching, but at any rate, here were people who were sent out to go to places where there were very primitive circumstances, and they would teach people how to get along and teach them something about morals that would lift them up out of the lifestyle they were living. I don't suppose today there's any group more hated by historians than quote-unquote Christian missionaries. Their work is looked on now as being bigots, cultural bigots. There's a term, religious pluralism. Let me give you a formal definition of that. Religious pluralism is the belief that multiple religions or secular worldviews are legitimate and valid, that each is true when viewed within its own culture. So those Christian missionaries that found folks out in the bush naked and cannibals worshiping trees, I mean, who's to say, after all, that that might not be just as valid as whatever they were bringing to them? This kind of idea that everything is the same and everybody has their own truth, it seems to me some of that had taken hold as these people had lost the respect for God as the God. And now let's just join in with everybody. It's a very modern concept if you think about what was going on in Jeremiah's day. And they were in such denial about it all. Let me go back here to Jeremiah chapter 2. And notice their complete indifference to their own circumstance. He asked the question in verse 14. He says, why is it that Israel is having so much trouble? Why are they robbed on every hand? They don't think about why that's so. Verse 17, hast thou not procured this unto thyself? Your conduct is the reason why God allows these nations to humble your soul. Verse 19, your own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backsliding shall reprove thee. Know therefore and see, it is an evil thing and bitter. Thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, and that my fear is not in thee. A nation that has lost its fear of God. Verse 27, they turn to the stock of a tree and say, you're my father, and to a stone. Thou hast brought me forth. They have turned their back unto me and not their face. Well, that says a lot, doesn't it? What a great expression. God says, this people turn, all right. They turn to me their back and not their face. That sounds very familiar to me. But notice the next phrase. But in the time of their trouble, they will say, arise and save us. Folks who are have a little bit of age on them in this room, remember, we're adults, when the Twin Towers were destroyed. You remember there were a few days when people got interested in God? You remember a few days when folks started being a little more reverent, a little more careful, a little more ashamed of their behavior? They got over it. And that's what God says about Judah a long time ago. He says, things get bad enough, they turn to me, but of course, not for long. Verse 30, in vain I have smitten your children. They receive no correction. Your own sword has destroyed your prophets. You won't take my discipline and you kill my messengers. And you have the audacity, verse 31, to say, we are lords, we're free. Now that kind of arrogance. Verse 34, here's the truth. In thy skirts is found the blood of the souls of the poor innocents. I have not found it by secret search. It's not hard to find the blood. It's everywhere. That sounds familiar too. Yet he says, thou sayest, because I am innocent, Surely his anger shall turn from me. Surely I will plead with thee. Because thou sayest, I have not sinned. Well, it's like Jefferson said, his justice will not wait forever. So, skipping on to chapter 9 of Jeremiah. By the way, I've got a little bit of license in moving around in Jeremiah because, you know, when you read Jeremiah, he doesn't exactly take it chronologically either, does he? That's one thing about it. So, maybe he won't mind if I do that in this brief lesson tonight. But in Jeremiah chapter 9, the coming storm, Jeremiah says that my head were waters. I could cry enough day and night for my nation. Then he says in verse 2, oh, that I had a place out in the wilderness that I could go and leave my people. Can you relate to that? I don't know sometimes whether to cry and spend the day crying or whether to try to find some place to get out away from everything. Jeremiah says they have bent their tongues like bows for lies. They're not valiant for the truth upon the earth. Folks that just cannot tell the truth. Has there ever been a time in America where dishonesty has been more mocked? Take heed, every one of his neighbor. Don't trust your brother. Every brother will utterly supplant. Every neighbor will walk with slanders. Deceivers, they don't speak the truth. We live in times. A friend of mine one time said, you know, when we were kids, he's about my age. He said, when we were kids, he said, we never locked our doors. He said, when we left, we'd leave on vacation, leave the door unlocked. He said, now I lock the door when I'm home. A nation of dishonesty. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God of hosts, behold, I will melt them and try them. For how shall I do for the daughter of my people? Their tongue is an arrow shot out. It speaks deceit. One speaketh peaceably to his neighbor with his mouth, but in his heart he lies in wait. Shall I not visit them for these things? Shall not my soul be avenged on a nation such as this? It's inevitable. And the reason, of course, is because there's not enough salt to save. Look back in the fifth chapter quickly. Chapter 5 and in verse 1, he goes through a list here of the circumstances involved. Run ye to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, and see now and know and seek in the broad places thereof if ye can find a man. The pronoun seems to be singular. If you can find one, I'm not looking for 50 or 10. Can you find one? If there be any that execute justice, that seek the truth, and I will pardon it. As the Lord lives, they swear falsely. Jeremiah said, well, this is just the people, maybe just a sorry group. Let me find other folks. These are the poor, the foolish. I'll get to the great men. Verse 5 says, and I spoke with them. They've known the way of the Lord, the judgments of God. But these have altogether broken the yoke and burst the bonds. There's just no one left, it seems, Jeremiah would say. They are filled with adultery. They're like animals in season, to be blunt, using his blunt language here. Shall I not visit them for these things? You know, adultery is used in the scriptures, both of literal adultery as well as materialism. You remember that in Colossians chapter 3, Paul writes that covetousness is idolatry. I think both spiritually and physically, America is consumed with adultery. And it sounds so familiar to us. In chapter 6 and in verse 7, Jeremiah writes, as a fountain cast out her waters, so she cast out her wickedness. Just like a spring, as it were, bubbling up filth in this case. Not clean water, but just pouring out filth. By the way, I don't know if this is something you've noticed or not. We've tried to keep cable television for the few benefits that it has. But I tell you, recently something happened that just sort of reminded me of what a mistake that is. This is my judgment now. But we got notice that we were getting a new channel on our cable system called the Vice Network, Vice Channel, Vice something. This is not some sort of extra pay pornography channel. This is a channel about vice. I haven't watched a minute of it, but you look at the guide, you know, and it's just one show after another about some wicked, filthy thing. I called up the cable company. I said, I don't want this. They said, well, it just comes with the package. I said, I still don't want it. I said, do you know what the word vice means? So I read this a definition of the word vice to the person on the phone. An immoral, evil habit or practice. Immoral conduct, depraved or degrading behavior. I said, why do we need a channel devoted to that? There's enough of it on the rest of it. But I was talking to some young woman in Toronto or somewhere that did not know or care what I was talking about. It's time to give up at that point. Can't reform it, not enough salt to keep it. Notice what he goes on to say here. Back in Jeremiah chapter 6, look in verse 10. To whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? Behold, their ear is uncircumcised. They cannot hearken. Behold, the word of the Lord is unto them a reproach. They have no delight in it. Therefore I am full of the fury of the Lord. I am weary with holding it in. I will pour it out upon the children abroad, upon the assembly of the young men together. For even the husband with the wife shall be taken, the aged with him that is full of days. He talks about every one of them, verse 13, is given to covetousness. Even the prophet, the priest, deals falsely. And they have healed my people, the hurt of my people, the daughter of my people, slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they committed abomination? They were not at all ashamed. Neither were they capable of blushing. Therefore, they shall fall among them that fall. At the time I visit, they shall be cast down, saith the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the way and see, and ask for the old paths, wherein is the good way, and walk therein. And ye shall find rest for your souls. And they say, we will not have it. And that includes the religious people. Here is religion, but it's a religion that's set up to please people, not to call them to something better. When a people have that kind of religion and love to have it so, how will they find God? In a world where nothing is certain, no principles are definite. Our faith is 2,000 years old, but our thinking isn't. Well, that's the problem. We're leaning on the popular vote rather than on the wisdom of God. And when Jeremiah wrote in the 7th chapter, he was told by God, go stand there at the temple, you remember. And here's what you say. Thus saith the Lord, do not trust in lying words like the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. This is the temple of the Lord. It's going to be okay. Verse 5. If ye thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if ye thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if ye oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to your hurt, I will cause you to dwell in this place. But ye trust in lying words, verse 8, that cannot profit. Will you steal and murder and commit adultery and swear falsely and burn incense to Baal and walk after other gods and then come and stand before me in this house which is called by my name and say, we're delivered to do all these things? Is this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? The Lord barred that expression, didn't he? For another time. Of course, he gave it in the first place. But the point is that when the Lord said that, he was reminding us of Jeremiah's day, and what Jeremiah was saying is, you've got a religion that sees nothing wrong with you being robbers. It doesn't change you. It doesn't influence you. It doesn't turn you over and convert you. It just makes you feel good about wherever you are. I tell you, that's a very modern problem. And what Jeremiah says is, you are kidding only yourself. Because God's not going to have it. And then he gives, this is the passage where he talks about Shiloh. And yeah, verse 12, he says, look at Shiloh. You remember Shiloh was the place where at one time the tabernacle sat. But God had taken the tabernacle away from there and never sent it back. And some say by this time the Assyrians had overrun the place. And I can just see Jeremiah saying, you think that this place is too holy to ever be overcome. Shiloh was holy too. What makes it holy is God. And God is not with you if you're not with Him. Now that's a simple lesson, but it's a needed lesson for every generation. A religion just trying to keep up with the culture is useless, worse than useless. And it'll be a factor in the destruction of any people. Chapter 5, verse 30, the prophets prophesy falsely and the priests bear rule by their means, and my people love to have it so. But what will the end thereof be? Jeremiah said in chapter 7, verse 27, therefore thou shalt speak all these words unto them, they will not hearken. Thou shalt call them, they won't answer. Thou shalt say unto them, this is a nation that obeyeth not the voice of the Lord their God, nor esteemeth correction. Truth is perished. It is cut off from their mouth. What's the it's a poignant expression there in chapter 8 and verse 20, isn't it? The harvest is past. The summer is ended. And we're not saved. Well, three times in the book of Jeremiah, God tells Jeremiah, don't pray for these people. Now, here's the thing. We understand a nation can turn. There are nations that have gone down the wrong road that have come back. And I don't know. That's the thing. I'm not Jeremiah. I don't know when that time is. God knows when that time is. And in this case, these folks had crossed the line. There is a line in God's mind when it's enough, when the iniquity is full. And for those, for that nation, he told Jeremiah, don't pray for them. It'll do no good to pray for these people. Don't intercede with me for these people. In the 14th chapter, don't pray for the welfare of this people. Though they fast, I will not hear their cry. And though they offer burnt offering and grain offering, I will not accept it. It's too late for them. Well, that's why Jeremiah preached those hard sayings. Why he preached those out-of-season sermons. Because it was the truth. He told them that the captivity was inevitable. And he also told them, don't be deceived by good news. All folks want to hear is good news. Remember chapter 37? The Babylonians, for a short time, they left the walls of Jerusalem after having encircled the people. They had a little trouble with the Egyptians. And Jeremiah said, don't let that fool you. They're going to be back. I'm telling you, this city will fall. He gathered the elders up and broke the pottery. And he said, this is the way it's going to be. This nation is going to be left in shards. It's going to be destroyed. Break the bottle before them and let them know that because of their sin, the sword will fall upon this place. He tells the story about the figs. You remember the two baskets of figs. And he says, actually, those who are captives are the good figs. They're going to be a lot better off than you are. Because those who are here are the ones who are going to suffer the most. And he also was the one who insisted, 70 years. 70 years. You remember some said, oh, no. Within 2 years, this will all be over. They were the same people who said the Babylonians would never come. And now they say, well, it won't last long. Jeremiah said, it's going to last your whole lifetime. And some of you are going to die in captivity, and some of you are never going to see those folks again. You're going to die before they get back. Well, not exactly sunshine, but it was the truth. And he paid a price, didn't he, for that? In the 15th chapter of Jeremiah, talks about the loneliness that he felt. And I know as you've gone through the book of Jeremiah, you have no doubt put yourself in his place and tried to feel what the prophet felt. I have sat I have not rather sat in the assembly of the mockers, nor rejoiced, but I sat alone because of thy hand, for thou hast filled me with indignation. You understand what it's like to live in your own country and feel out of step with everything going on? And you understand Jeremiah, the physical abuse that he took. In the 20th chapter, fellow didn't like what he said, and so they hit him, and they put him in the stocks. Ever thought about what it'd be like to be in stocks, to have your hands and feet stuck through some sort of wooden device and not be able to straighten out, not be able to lie down? We're doing the right thing. In the 20th chapter in verse 9, I don't think it didn't work on his mind. There are times when Jeremiah was discouraged. He said, there were times when I said, I will not make mention of him. And I won't speak anymore in his name. But the word was in mine heart as a burning fire shut up in my bones. I was weary with forbearing. I could not stay. Sometimes he thought, I'll just quit. What's the old saying? Old brother one time said about working in a hard place, trying to teach the gospel and be a Christian and do the best he could for the church at a place. He said, you know, if I was working for the brethren, I'd quit. But I'm working for the Lord and can't. And that was Jeremiah. He was working for the Lord and he could not quit. But they mocked him. The 20th chapter strikes us as well. Look in verse 11. The Lord is with me as a mighty and terrible one. My persecutors shall stumble. They shall prevail. They shall not prevail, rather. Who are these persecutors? Look in verse 10. For I heard the defaming of many. I'm reading the King James translation here. Fear on every side. Brother Humphreys, who wrote the commentary on Jeremiah, he understands this expression this way. He suggests that the defaming is found in that phrase. He suggests that those who were enemies of Jeremiah would see him coming and say of Jeremiah, oh, here's old fear on every side. Why don't you come tell us another bad dream story? Maybe that's the case. Report, say they, and we will report it. That's translated different ways too. But one way to look at that is to say that they were just waiting for Jeremiah. You tell us something, and if we can get something we can use out of it, you can believe this, you'll be in jail before nightfall. You ever been in a place where every word you said was being taken down by somebody trying to find a way to destroy you? Maybe you've never been in a place like that, but Jeremiah knew what it was like. In fact, they imprisoned him as a traitor. They said, oh, you're with the Babylonians. You're for them. He said, it's not so. They put him in a vaulted prison. You think about some of the fine people who have lived, some of the best ever lived, who had to go to jail for the cause of God. It happened to a lot of great servants of God, men and women, I suppose. Do you suppose that I'm too good to do that? Or that you are? I'll tell you, if it came to a point where we had to be put in a place like this, we wouldn't be the first. And it wouldn't be more than God has a right to ask of us. Jeremiah certainly did come to those points where he was discouraged. And you've read them and I've read them in Jeremiah. In chapter 15, unless I've misread the passage, he speaks, I think, unwisely here. When he says, why is my pain unceasing and my wound incurable? Refusing to be healed. Will you be to me like a deceitful brook, like waters that fail? Really crossing the line of irreverence, they're suggesting that God's use of him, he had treated him badly, that God has been like some sort of brook that dries up when I need you. God's answer reflects that, I think. Patient and yet firm. He says, therefore thus saith the Lord, if you return, I will restore you, and you shall stand before me. Jeremiah, you need to straighten up your thinking and where you are now and come back to me in the first place. We might have sympathy for Jeremiah, pushed as he was, but the Lord said, you need to come back to me. And then he said this, if you utter what is precious and not what is worthless, You will be as my mouth, and they shall turn to you, but you shall not turn to them. He said, Jeremiah, all you've got is what I give you. And you tell them, if you want to be one with those people and have fellowship with them, the only way you can do that is if they come to you after preaching my word. You can't compromise. It's not yours to compromise. It still isn't. All warned about preachers who want to scratch the ears of those who want to hear it their way. It's not your word to give away. Jeremiah knew that. God said, I'll make you to this people a fortified wall, a city of bronze. They'll fight against you, but they'll not prevail. I'm with you to save you. I'm glad somebody was with him, because certainly he didn't have many helpers in the government of Judah, that's for sure. You have a fellow like Jehoiakim. We don't have time to tell his story tonight, but you know that story. Most of you do. If not, read chapter 36. It's a powerful story about the king of Israel taking the words of God written on the scroll and just taking a penknife and cutting it up and casting it into the fire. I guess there is room for things to get worse, isn't there? I've seen, and you've seen, a lot of politicians in America who don't have much respect for righteousness, but I hadn't yet quite seen anybody so bold as just to cut up a Bible and throw it in the fire. Maybe next week that'll happen, or some other time. But that was the days of Jeremiah. Well, by the time Zedekiah comes to the throne, he is a pathetic creature, isn't he? He's really a sad character, who calls Jeremiah in and wants to know, well, what's the word of God about this? The 17th verse of chapter 37, Zedekiah the king sent and took him secretly into the house. Any word from the Lord? And Jeremiah said, yeah, the same word I've been preaching on the streets. It's the same word. And the word is, you need to surrender to Babylon. This city is marked. And if you do that, God will be merciful. If you don't, it will be a disaster. Jeremiah is put in prison eventually, taken by his enemies and put down, you remember, in a dungeon filled with mire, and left there to die. And if it had not been for the original Ethiopian eunuch who called on the king, Jeremiah's going to die. You've got to lift him out. Well, then give the order. Lift him out. Zedekiah is blown by the wind. He wants to do right, but he's afraid. And in chapter 38, you remember that story. After he's saved from the mire, he comes back to the king's presence. And Zedekiah brings him in. And he asks again, what should we do? Jeremiah tells him the same thing. He says, if you go forth to the king of Babylon, you will live, and the city will be spared a great deal of destruction. But if you won't go forth, it's going to be a disaster. And Zedekiah in verse 19 said, I am afraid. I am afraid of the Jews. You know, he was, I don't remember, how old was he, 21? When he began to reign? You know, we can try to excuse him on different levels. But you know, Jeremiah was about that same age when he was called by God. And I'm sure there were people who would have been glad to have put a knife in his back if he had made that suggestion. But Jeremiah says to him, O king, I beseech you, hear the word of the Lord. Be more afraid of God than you are these folks, and do what's right. But he wouldn't. He didn't think he could. And you know the story. Chapter 39 tells the story about what happened. Babylon crushing in, the king tries to escape, flee the city. He's caught, brought before the king of Babylon. They killed his sons, verse 6, before his eyes. And so that would be the last thing he ever saw. Then they put his eyes out and carried him away for the rest of his miserable life, a captive, destroyed. But we think, good for Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah is now lifted out of this prison. And Jeremiah is going to be treated right by the Babylonians. And if we didn't know better, we might think, and they lived happily ever after. But you know, that's not the way it happened, was it? They put a fellow in charge named Gedaliah, who was, it seems, a good man. And he was assassinated by a man named Ishmael, the John Wilkes Booth of his day, who murdered the governor. And the people then are terrified and frightened. The Babylonians will kill us. We've got to go to Egypt. What should we do? Jeremiah, tell us, what should we do? You go to God, and you ask God for us, what should we do? And whatever you say, we'll do it. But they already had their bags packed, didn't they? So Jeremiah goes, and he comes back, and he says, thus saith the Lord, you stay right here, and it'll be well. And they say, oh, you're lying. Okay. Well, they take Jeremiah, and they all go down to Egypt. Then in chapter 43, we find Jeremiah in Egypt, and he's preaching in Egypt. And he says, let me tell you, the king of Babylon is going to set his pavilion up right here on this stone. You ran down here because you didn't want to face him. He's coming right here. And what will he do? He'll bring death to those who have death coming to them, captivity to captivity, and sword to sword. The same message he had preached all those years. I wonder if the older preachers in this audience sometimes feel like, you know, when are people going to listen? I remember an older preacher when I was a kid. He said, you know, I've been preaching on the marriage law my whole life, and the divorce rate gets worse and worse. I'm sure it's not because of his preaching. But that's the way it was for Jeremiah. I don't know what his end was, but I'm sure that he spent his last day trying to call people back to God. Now, what lessons do we learn from all of this? I appreciate the kind way that you've listened. I especially appreciate the mamas and dads who have worked with these little ones. Thank you very much. Let me quickly, in closing, make a point or two, and then we'll bring the meeting to a close here. In the first place, what Jeremiah's lesson teaches me is that God expects us to serve Him our whole life, no matter what it cost. I think Jeremiah knew that. He understood that there was no promise that it would be a happy ending on this earth, and that it would all work out and people would see and it would all become clear to everybody. The Lord wanted our disciples to know that same thing, that in this life it was always going to be a fight. You remember in Matthew chapter 10, the message that God shared with the Lord shared with his apostles is the same message that you and I need to remember. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foe shall be they of his own household. And he that loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. The Lord said, I'm sending you out in a world of wolves, and you're the sheep. And he said, what I want you to do is be loyal to me no matter what it costs you. And you might be like Wes, who spent his whole life in a tub of butter and everything's great, or you might be like Jeremiah, who lives in a time when it cost him every day and every step was hard and the road was full of rocks. But whatever your road is, you follow it, he says. He doesn't bat an eye when he demands that we serve him no matter what it costs. Another thing we learn from Jeremiah is we only have one message. And we have to stick with that message. I'm struck by that passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And maybe this principle is one that you reflect on as well. You know, Paul said that we're called to preach the gospel. We are called to share the message of God with the world. And it pleases God when we do that. Sometimes, however, what we have to say stinks like death to some. It smells like glory to others. But regardless of whether it is, as he says, the savor of death unto death or the savor of life unto life, we are under God a sweet savor of Christ. I don't believe Jeremiah had a lot of people, it doesn't seem like it, that he could say, now look, these folks stand with me. But I believe Jeremiah pleased God in all that he did for him. You know, God doesn't call on you to convert the world. He calls on you to teach, to live it, to stand for it, to invite everybody that you can. They'll make up their choice. What we can never do is try to find a way to adjust the word to make it seem good to them. We're called by the truth, and that truth must not be tampered with by me or anybody else. Don't expect the praise of men. That's something else that we have to learn as we go along. Jeremiah knew that, and certainly we ought to know that. Finally, take your satisfaction in doing the right thing. Let me turn finally to that familiar passage in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Paul wrote about his coming in. He looked back and he said, I am ready to be offered. The time of my departure is at hand. I've fought a good fight. I've finished the course. I've kept the faith. There's laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me at that day, and not to me only, but to all them that love his appearing. We were reading the other day from Romans chapter 2, where Paul writes, to them who by patient continuance in well-doing seek for glory and honor and immortality, eternal life. There are a lot of great things about being a Christian now. There are blessings now with persecutions, the Lord said. But there is a place that will be free from any alloy. A place of righteousness and peace and joy and reward. As the Apostle Paul said in chapter 8 and verse 18 of that same book of Romans, he said, for I reckon or I count that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. What does the future hold? I don't know. But looking back at the lessons of the past, I know that nations will not stand, any nation, no nation will stand forever if it continues to dishonor God. But I know that God's people, in whatever circumstance they find themselves in, have the protection and care of God if they stand for Him, if they do His work. My plea for you and for me is that we might remember God doesn't promise us here that we'll be popular. What He does say is, if you serve me, I'll be with you. I hope that simple lesson will resonate with us as we face whatever time we have. Thank you for your kind attention tonight and this week. Please do get the songbooks out. Turn to the number that's been selected. If it be your desire tonight to join with Christ, to take a stand against the evil of this world, and to be a part of the solution instead of the problem, then tonight is the night to do that. We're not promised tomorrow. Why not tonight? Come and confess Jesus as Lord. I believe He's the Son of God. Come in penitence. Come and be immersed in water, dead to sin, raised to walk in newness of life. If you're here tonight as one who has not done that, or has done that rather, but you have not been faithful to that commitment that you made, then don't wait. Come to Him. Come back to Him now. If we might help you, let us know how, please. While we stand,